Let me just remind you of where we're headed here. This is the last week of this preliminary discussion. We get into consideration of passages in Deuteronomy beginning next week. We have two. We'll be led in our discussion by Stephen Haig and Mr. Tan on those first two. I'd like the rest of you, as you recall, to write a page or so. Look over those passages. Just write a brief page exposition of them in preparation for class, and then we'll be led in a more detailed discussion by Mr. Haig and Mr. Tan. Now, some of you who are not giving oral reports have to pick one of these for a more detailed discussion. And if one of these happens to be one you're doing, or in the, you know, be prepared for that next week. Just turn in the written form of that. Okay? Question? No, it's not this. No. No. If you're doing, you're leading the presentation, that is your assignment, and you don't need to do a brief exposition.
For the other person?
For the other, for everybody who's not doing it. Yes.
Well, I mean, like, I guess Stephen's doing the other one.
Yeah, well, then that's right. I do want a page for his, but not for yours. Okay. In other words, you're exempt on the one that you're leading. Otherwise, you're responsible for it. Yes, get back to our discussion. We were discussing centralization of worship issue. Last week we looked at the place of centralization of worship in Wellhausen's reconstruction of Israel's religious development. What we want to do today is be on your sheet a suggested response to Wellhausen's view of the centralization of worship in ancient Israel. And what I'm going to do initially here is give you pretty much the way in which B. Holward has argued against Wellhausen's position. If you look on your bibliography, page 5, bottom of the page is centralization of worship in Deuteronomy, and you notice the fourth entry there is B. Holward, the Plots die de Heere Verkiezenzal. It's a Dutch article translated, the place that the Lord shall choose. That article has not been translated into English. I think it's quite a good article. And much of what I'll say here is pretty much the way he develops his thesis from that article. Holward mentions that in the history of opposition to Wellhausen's theory, most of the objections are directed against various details of his system. Now, you see, here's Wellhausen's system, and you get critics of the system, and they'll focus on this detail or that detail or some other detail. But a lot of the opposition to Wellhausen's system has been directed against various details of his system. But what he argues is that it should be realized that the centralization issue, centralization of worship, is the key point in the whole system. In other words, you're going to get at the Wellhausen system, that centralization issue is the key issue in his whole system. And he says when you look at the Old Testament, you notice quite quickly that in the historical books that cover the time from the judges up to and including the time of the kingdom. Period of the judges, up to and including the time of the kingdom. You repeatedly find multiplicity of altars referred to. And that being the case, multiplicity of elders, from judges up to the kingdom period. He says it's hardly satisfactory to say that worship was illegal or illegitimate in all these places where reference is made to worship, apart from worship at the tabernacle or later in the temple. Now, he says, of course, there are examples of worship that was illegitimate, that was not in conformity with the Mosaic laws. For example, in Judges 17, you remember that story of a fellow named Micah who had these household idols, and a Levite comes by and he takes the idols, and then he migrates to the north with the Danites and he sets up a place of worship there and an altar. Certainly that worship was illegitimate. It goes against the requirements of the Mosaic law. Also, the complaint about Jeroboam the son of Nebat, when you read the books of Kings after the time of the division of the kingdom, every king in the north is said he followed in the way of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And what that sin was, he had built those golden calves and altars at Bethel and Dan in the north. Now, I think the issue is, what Hallward thinks the issue is, not so much the issue that there was an altar in the north, which would have been legitimate, but you had golden calf worship, which was certainly a violation of the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any image or any likeness. So you can find examples of worship and altars that were illegitimate, but you also find many that for which there's no condemnation made, and they're very godly people who are sacrificing at these altars, and it seems to be perfectly legitimate. So in that period, from judges through to the kingdom, it seems like multiplicity of altars is not condemned per se. An illustration Hallward brings out, and I think this is an important one, is in the ministry of Elijah. Remember, Elijah confronted Ahab at Mount Carmel, and in that process, he restored an altar that had been broken down. And then you had that contest between the Lord, Yahweh, and Baal, and the Lord answered Elijah's prayer, and fire came from heaven and lit that altar as a demonstration of the existence and power of Yahweh over against Baal, who couldn't do that. And certainly that was an altar that was an altar apart from the altar at the temple. And that was subsequent to the time that the temple had been built. And rather than condemnation of another altar, it seems the Lord sanctioned that altar in the north in the time of Ahab. And later he says, I think this is in the context when Elijah is discouraged as he's fleeing from Jezebel. He says in 1 Kings 19:10, you know, this was after he fled all the way down to Mount Horeb. And the word of the Lord says to him, "What are you doing here?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with a sword. I am the only one left." And you see, his complaint is not that there are too many altars, but that the Israelites were breaking down the altars of the Lord. They weren't using the altars of the Lord. They weren't paying attention to the prophets. That's 1 Kings 19:10. "They've rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with a sword." So, you know, someone could argue that says nothing about the legality of sacrifices having been brought to Jerusalem, or the legality of those brought elsewhere to Jerusalem, but that doesn't really seem like an adequate response to this. It seems that certainly altars, there's nothing wrong with altars apart from Jerusalem. Yeah.
And the fact that he went down to the rest, he didn't do that. I mean, that's certainly a place where the Lord shared himself to Moses and the Israelites. And he might have been seeking refuge. And the best way to do was still hold the ground, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, but give any credence to what then?
To this idea of being that multiplicity of authors is not an idea that goes against the Mosaic law.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, maybe so. I don't know that the issue. See, I think the issue is an issue that's been created by Wellhouse and those people that followed him. It seems like to Elijah, multiplicity of elders was no issue. Because it was just accepted. Sure, there are a lot of elders. There's a central altar in Jerusalem, but there are a lot of other altars. It wasn't that there was some history of progression from many altars to one altar. I mean, that seems like a concept that's just totally foreign to him.
What about the records from the high places?
Well, we'll come back to that. That's more confusing. Yeah. Now, of course, there were altars on high places, but I'll just say this at this point. We'll come back and look at that in more detail. It seems that some of the high places were illegitimate because they're taken over from the Canaanites, which was specifically prohibited. It seems that some of the other high places, the worship was a worship to the Lord. In fact, that's specifically said in certain cases, and there seems to be nothing wrong with it. But it does seem that at the high places, gradually, you began to get this sort of syncretistic kind of worship and confusion between Baal worship and worship of the Lord. And at that point, it became wrong. So that you get those kings in the north, of which it said they did good in the eyes of the Lord, say Josiah, Hezekiah. Except they didn't, Josiah did tear them down, but say Asa and Hezekiah, they did good in the eyes of the Lord, except they didn't tear down the high places. And that seems like something that's sort of a blot on their reign to some extent. They should have torn them down. But then the question is, why should they have torn them down? Is it because there was an altar outside of Jerusalem? That would be one possible answer. Or is it because there was heathen worship being carried on? I'm inclined to think it's the latter. Or at least syncretistic worship. But we'll come back to that. The books of Samuel are particularly important with respect to this question. Samuel was certainly a prophet of the Lord, a reformer, called the people back to the Lord away from heathen worship. He built a number of altars at different places. And in chapter 9 of 1 Samuel, you read in verse 12, when Saul is out looking for his lost cattle, and his servant says, let's go inquire of this man of God, Samuel, the seer. Verse 12 says, when they come to the town, and ask, is the seer here? They respond, he is. He's ahead of you. Hurry now. He's just come to our town today, for the people have a sacrifice at the high place. And as you read down through that chapter, you find Samuel goes and officiates at the sacrifice at the high place. Verse 13 says, as soon as you enter the town, you will find him. Before he goes up to the high place to eat, the people will not begin eating until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Go up now. You should find him about this time. And verse 19 says, I am the seer, Samuel replied. Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you are to eat with me, and in the morning I will let you go and tell you all that is in your heart. And verse 25 says, after they came down from the high place into the town, Samuel talked with Saul on the roof of the house and so forth. But it seems quite clear that Samuel sacrificed, and there was this sacrificial meal that Saul partook in at Gibeah? Let's see. Maybe it doesn't locate it. No, it's Ramah. It's Ramah. Well, C see where it tells us that, but I'm quite sure it's at Rhema. Anybody see that?
Five.
I don't see it. It's not terribly important. But in any case, Samuel sacrifices at a high place this town. I think that is Rhema. But in chapter 7, he sacrifices at, in verse 6, at Mizpah, 7:6. When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew out water, poured it out before the Lord, and that day they fasted, they confessed, we have sinned against the Lord. Samuel was the leader of Israel at Mizpah. And verse 9 says, he took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him. So that's another place where he sacrificed. In chapter 11, he does it at Gilgal. 11:15, Samuel said, let's go to Gilgal and reaffirm the kingship. So all the people went to Gilgal, confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. They sacrificed fellowship offerings. So he went to these various places, certainly a number of altars where Samuel sacrificed. Later in the book, chapter 16, when the Lord tells Samuel to go anoint David to replace Saul as king, you read in the second verse, this verse has often been discussed from another perspective, from the ethical question that it raises, but you see the first verse, the Lord says to Samuel, 1 Samuel 16:1, how long will you mourn for Saul? Since I have rejected him as king over Israel, fill your horn with oil, be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem, I've chosen one of his sons to be king. Samuel said, how can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me. What's the Lord's response? The Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. So it must have been not unusual for sacrifices to have been offered in Bethlehem. And in that way, Saul would not realize what was going on. I won't get into the ethical side of that. But as far as the altars, maybe you're more interested in the other thing than the altars. That's an interesting interesting passage. It gets into, that's 1 Samuel 16:2. It gets into the question, is it ever right to deceive someone? I think there are cases where there's no obligation not to deceive someone, where it's not you're not culpable for deceiving, and particularly in contexts of almost war like it is here, where there's a life at stake, you have a higher obligation, it seems to me, to the other person involved than you do to, in quotes, tell the truth. Then you get into the question of what's truth, what is a lie, definitional question, semantics of that. It gets very complicated, but I don't think you can address that issue. You know, I've discussed this in Old Testament history. I don't think you can address that issue apart from the ninth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. It's not just an abstract commitment to truth. There's another, it's you by your words are to protect your neighbor. That's your positive obligation. And it seems to me to work out the implications of that. This kind of a text is consistent with that view. And there are other texts in the Old Testament that are be taken in a similar way. And, you know, particularly you get into that kind of thing, like I've said in Old Testament history, some of the Korean fellows here probably know a lot about the war type of situation in Korea. My wife grew up in the Netherlands in an occupied country. And her parents housed Jews and protected them. And, you know, you get that old question, what if the SS knocks on your door, what do? You say, here they are, or do you deceive them? I think it's your Christian responsibility to deceive them. That's not bearing false witness against your neighbor, as I do. But that's a, you know, people can have different conclusions on that. They're tough questions. I think, were you going to say something?
In this case, it seems more concealment.
Yeah. Well, yeah. In Walter Kaiser's book on ethics, he tries to make that distinction and say that it's never right to deceive. But in some cases, you can conceal. And uses this as an illustration where you could conceal. Which we never know whether Samuel was questioned. What are you doing? Whether so. But suppose he had been. And he says, I'm going to do that. That is true. It's concealing his true intent, his true reason for going there. But he's deceiving Saul at the same time, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not sure that distinction helps that much.
Yeah.
All right. Granted. But that's a technicality, I think, because the end result is the same. He's led to believe one thing when in actual fact he's going for another reason. So even though technically you can argue that, is that distinction really worth a whole lot? See what I'm saying? Maybe it's worth something.
Well, that's deception is different from lying. It's not lying.
Yeah, that's true. That's a legitimate distinction. You see, Hodge says about a lie, even if you say something that doesn't correspond to reality, Hodge says, semantically, you might say it's just a thing of semantics, he says that's not a lie if there's no obligation to tell the truth. In certain circumstances, you don't have an obligation to tell the truth, so if you don't tell the truth, it's not a lie. So then it depends on how you define your terms, too. That'll take us way aside from this question. Where were we? Oh, 1 Samuel 16:2. Point is, there's an altar apparently at Bethlehem, and in this time doesn't seem at all unusual somebody go to Bethlehem to sacrifice, which would not be at the tabernacle.
But these historical references would Wellhausen and his school, you know, say something about them being written later. How
are
they explaining?
No, they see, this still would fit with his theory, because he would say at this point, before 621, you had multiplicity of altars.
Okay.
So he'd appeal to this to show as well that you have multiplicity of altars.
But he'd say that the Mosaic laws that we have, like in Deuteronomy, is supposed to simple to say subversive.
That's
later.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah. All right, another illustration. On the occasion when David was not at his place at Saul's table. Chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. Saul excuses him initially on the assumption that he was unclean. This was on the occasion of a feast on the new moon day. And you read in 20:26, Saul said nothing that day, for he thought David wasn't there at his place. Something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he's unclean. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go, because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' That is why he has not come to the king's table." Now, of course, that had been arranged by David and Jonathan previously, that this was the response that would be made. But again, the point in connection with what we're discussing is Saul would have thought perfectly normal that David would have gone to Bethlehem to offer that sacrifice. So it gave a legitimate excuse. Nobody sees a deviation from the law in that. Now, those are some of the references that show multiplicity of altar. But then some people respond and say that Deuteronomy 12 says, "When he giveth you rest," that's in verse 1 and verse 10, Verse 12 says, these are the decrees, the laws you must be careful to follow in the land the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess. As long as you live in the land, verse 10 says, but you will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies round about you, so that you will live in safety. And some people say these were unstable times, time of Samuel, Saul. And Deuteronomy 10 says that these laws are to be followed when the Lord gives you rest. Or excuse me, Deuteronomy 12, verse 10, says these are the laws to be followed when the Lord gives you rest. And then 2 Samuel 7, verse 1 and 11 is pointed to. 2 Samuel 7 is that chapter where the Lord gives David the promise that he will build him a house. And you read in 2 Samuel 7, verse 1, after the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies. And verse 10 says, I will provide a place for my people Israel and plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I also will give you rest from all your enemies. So many people say that the conditions or the condition of rest did not develop where Deuteronomy 12 would apply until the time of David, when in 2 Samuel 7 it says the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies. So, yeah.
You read the book of Judges, you find that phrase often given after when the
judges
were raised up and they had victory.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's too strong. That's what I was going to say. I don't think that solves the problem for these reasons. That's one of them. But also, notice this, as an objection to that kind of argument, that 2 Samuel 7 is only at that point that the conditions are developed that would cause Deuteronomy 12 to have applicability or to apply. Notice that Absalom, even after 2 Samuel 7, organized his revolution at a sanctuary in Hebron. 2 Samuel 15, verse 7, you read there, at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord. While your servant was living at Geshur in Aram, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron. So the king said to him, go in peace. So he went to Hebron. And of course, again, it's a deception. He's representing himself to be going to Hebron to pay his vow and to worship the Lord. And paying a vow included offering of sacrifices. It must have been an altar in Hebron. And Absalom does that, but he does it with the agreement of David. Which is 2 Samuel 6. So there were still, it seems, with no question involved, altars apart from the central altar. And then also, if the rest that's talked about in Deuteronomy 12:10, refers to rest from external enemies, then Deuteronomy 12 would be applicable only for very brief periods, mostly during and after the time of Solomon. It seems much better to understand the term rest, not as to external enemies, but internal. See, David's reference there in 2 Samuel 7 is the external enemy. And it seems better to understand that Deuteronomy 12 reference as to internal enemies. And that rest was really achieved immediately after the conquest. Remember when the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh came across to help in the conquest, then they went back to their territory to the east of the Jordan. You read in Joshua 22:4. Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest, as he promised, return to your homes in the land that Moses, servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. The rest was achieved immediately after the conquest. And those internal enemies were defeated. The Canaanites were defeated. And if that's the case, that means that the law of Deuteronomy 12 would be in effect and in application during the time of Samuel, during the time of Saul. And that we can better look for it there than during the time of David. And as Mr. Patain pointed out, you also have that reference periodically through the book of Judges after victory has been achieved over some of these internal enemies, which they were mostly internal in the book of Judges, with maybe one exception. Yeah, well, that's right at the time of the conquest.
And,
yeah.
But how? I mean, some of them, I don't know the length of time or duration of time they remain present as a test for Israel.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, they would never receive internal rest in a sense.
Yeah. Well. Yes and no. It probably depends on how you answer it. See, if you look at Joshua 21:43, you read there, so the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their forefathers. They took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises of the house of Israel failed. Everyone was fulfilled. So, you know, that sounds like it's put in pretty absolute terms, yet you turn over to the first chapter of the book of Judges and you find a number of the tribes that says they'd not yet possessed this part of their territory, not possessed that. There was still much to be done. I think what's referred to in Joshua is that the resistance was really broken and the people were enabled to go in and settle down in their assigned territories. And that the conquest of the land was something that had really been accomplished, yet there still remained work to be done. So, that was 21:43 and 44. Well, so there's the case of Absalom in 2 Samuel 15. There's this reference to rest back in Joshua 22. The other thing is this. What about Exodus 20:24-26? We haven't looked at that yet. Let me read that. Exodus 20:24-26. This is often called the law of the altar. The Israelites are told, make an altar of earth for me, sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle, wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones, for you will defile it if you use a tool on it. Do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it. Now, what's the point of all the regulations about building of altars in Exodus 20, 24 to 26? Why does it talk about uncut stones and an altar of earth? Was that meant only for the wilderness period? There's no indication of that. It seems to be meant for the time that Israel would come into the land of Canaan. You notice the regulations concern how the altars were to be built. Do not build it with dressed stones. Don't make steps. That sort of thing. It's to be an altar of earth. And it also says, it also addresses the places where they were to be located. How they were to be built, where they were to be located. Wherever I cause my name to be honored. The NIV translation. That's where an altar can be built. NIV says, excuse me, King James says, in all places where I record my name. But it seems like there was to be some sort of divine sanction of a place. In other words, God chooses a place. And then there are these regulations about what type of altar it would be. But there's no indication there's only to be one altar. And it seems that the practice, particularly during the time of Samuel, clearly corresponds to this legislation. There are a number of altars where Samuel sacrificed. So the question is, how do you harmonize, of course, Wellhausen addressed this issue, how do you harmonize Exodus 20, 24 to 26 with Deuteronomy 12? What Wellhausen did was to say there's a long period of development between the two laws. Exodus 20, 24 to 26 represents that early period where you have multiplicity of altars. You have a long period of time, the time of Josiah, and then you get the centralization. You move from the one situation to the other. But the question is, have we really read Deuteronomy 12 correctly? If we think that Deuteronomy 12 requires one central altar, or one altar alone, one legitimate place of worship, does Deuteronomy 12 really demand that kind of centralization? Doesn't, then of course there's no conflict between Exodus and Deuteronomy. If it does require only one legitimate altar, I think there is a conflict between Exodus and Deuteronomy 12. 12:14. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, a hut, of course, in the advocate, number one.
Yeah.
Number one.
Mm-hmm.
Or all you know, first.
Yeah.
But some other, you know, scholars suggested, you know, it could be in that article.
All right.
Some or any.
Yes. All right, that's where you're anticipating right where I'm going next. That's the point. It's a good point. Let me give you Halder. That's right where we're going. Let me give you what Halder does with Deuteronomy 12 in response to that problem, how to relate Exodus and Deuteronomy 12. And Deuteronomy 12:14 is a key verse, which Mr. Kim has just brought up. So you have Ki'im Bamakom, Asher Yivhar Adonai Be'ahaz Shivateka. But in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes, in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes. And then that goes on to say, there shalt thou offer thy burnt offerings. Now, I think for that statement, you need to go back to verse 13, which says, take heed to thyself, that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest. Don't offer your offerings in every place you see. You see, in contrast to that, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes, there bring your sacrifices. Now, the first impression might be there's only to be one place and one alone where sacrifices are to be brought. Now, Hallward says you can't stop with the first impression. The expression, one of your tribes, this Be'ahaz Shevateka, one of your tribes, does not necessarily indicate only one. It may have the idea of the English any. But in the place which the Lord shall choose in any of your tribes. Now, the way he works this out, he uses several illustrations. The way he works this out, he appeals to Deuteronomy 18:6, where you have a verse, if a Levite come from one of thy gates, Wiki Yavo. Now, if Yavo enters, the Levite, Halewi, Me'ahaz She'areka. Now, if a Levite comes from, see, literally, it's Ahad, the same, but Ahad. Here it's Me'ahaz, it's the same term. The idea is, if a Levite comes from any of your towns, that's the way NASB translates. You could translate it from one of your towns, but of course, the idea is not that if a Levite comes from only one, it's the idea is if he comes from any of your towns. Or Deuteronomy 23:17. Where you have he, speaking of a slave there, will dwell with you imakah yeshev Bekirbaka Bamakom. He will dwell with you in any place which he shall choose within Be'ahad She'areka, within any of your gates. Seems clear again that the Ahad is be understood as any, in any of your gates. Now the other thing is, in this get back to this 12:14, you have that term one in there, which can be translated any. The other thing is you have Bamakom, in the place, singular, with a definite article. And it'll be argued, isn't that in the singular, doesn't that mean one place only? If more than one was meant, wouldn't you expect a plural? And again, Holbert's answer is not necessarily. He appeals to number 16, verse 7. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. And it shall be Ha'ish, the man, singular, definite article. Whom the Lord chooses, he shall be the one who is holy. In the context of number 16, the context is the uprising against the leadership of Moses by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And in verse 7, you read, the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy. The man is singular, but the question is if the office of the priest and leader is to be confined to Moses and Aaron, or is it to be extended to 250 other people? So you have a choice between two plurals. The leadership to be reside with Moses and Aaron or with these 250 other people? And the response is, the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. The meaning is clear. It's the men. It's either Moses and Aaron. It's Moses and Aaron. But it's the men in either case. It's either the 250 or it's the two. The article, you see, can be used in a distributive sense. Not a restrictive sense. A distributive sense instead of a restrictive sense. If you look at... look down here at Ezekiel 18:4. Ezekiel 18:4 is, the soul that sins will die. Inah ha-nefesh. The soul, singular. The soul that sins will die. That doesn't mean there's only one soul that's going to sin that's going to die. It's distributive. Any soul that sins is going to die. And in fact, if you go back, you see we already looked at Deuteronomy 18:6. Now, if a Levite, it should be the Levite, you see, if a Levite comes from any of your towns, that's ha-Lewi. That doesn't mean one Levite only, it means any Levite. And in Deuteronomy 23:17 that we already looked at, the slave will dwell with you in any place, that's bamakom. That's singular too. So it's a distributive sense of the article. It's not restricted. You can't say that only one specific person, to the exclusion of all others, is going to die in Ezekiel 18:4. The word applies to everyone to whom the qualification applies. So if you go back up here to Deuteronomy 12:14, but in the place which the Lord your God shall choose in any of your tribe. The place doesn't mean necessarily only one place, but any place that the Lord shall choose in any of your tribes is a possible reading. And that's the way Hallward reads that text. Now, there are a number of those phrases in Deuteronomy chapter 12. I want to go back and look at some of them. I think we better take a 10-minute break. We're a bit over time. Take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and we'll go further with this. We're good.